Are there any questions about lectures? Nobody has any questions? I'm trying to think, was there any good email questions I got recently? I can't think of any off the top of my head, so I guess we'll just continue or start this lecture. This slide is just a continuation from the last lecture. Remember I told you guys about the birds and the bees? Yes, last lecture. So this lecture, I'll just have a few slides. This is a whiptail lizard. What was unique about the whiptail lizard again? It's parthenogenic, right? So this is a female. It has its offspring are all daughters. They're genetically identical to this lizard. Oh, and I do remember one question I got in the email. I sort of mentioned this in the last lecture, but it is the case that parthenogenic females, the offspring are genetically identical to the mom. So they the eggs are formed not through a reduction division, so they're diploid eggs that are formed, and they're not fertilized. And so except for any mutations that occurred during the formation of the eggs, just like any cell division has some mutations associated with it, the offspring are identical. And that is different from selfing hermaphrodites, where the selfing hermaphrodites, or a hermaphrodite that has both sexes, produces both types of gametes. So assortment, independent assortment, and recombination are occurring in the formation of the offspring, in the formation of the gametes, rather. And so the offspring that are formed through the fertilization of those gametes are different than the mom or dad, whatever you call it. Okay? Anyway, so that's just to reiterate a point that I had in the email. And this is Daphnia. This is the water flea. It's a crustacean. And this is just showing the eggs. So you can see that there's not a lot of them, and they take up a good proportion of the body mass of this individual. This is a Daphnia are unique because they can reproduce asexually, that is through parthenogenesis, or they can decide to be sexual, right? So they're unique in that way. And the important point about Daphnia is you might think that the reason why we're sexual organisms, for instance, is because we don't have a choice. Well, a lot of organisms do, right? And so natural selection must be favoring the evolution of sex for some reason, and I gave a couple of explanations for why sex has persisted, right? You purge deleterious mutations more easily, you can evolve more rapidly, that is, you can fix multiple beneficial mutations more rapidly, and the individuals that are, the offspring that are produced are more variable, okay? So what I want to do today is discuss two phenomena that would, on the face of it, appear difficult to evolve, okay? The first thing I'm going to be talking about is sexual selection, and then the second thing, if I have time, I'll be talking about is the evolution of altruistic behavior, okay? And basically, sexual selection is based on this observation that many organisms are dimorphic. That is to say, the sexes differ in their form, right? Humans differ a little bit. Males are most males are bigger than most females in human species. But some species, I will show you some examples, are highly dimorphic. And in some cases, in some species, the males of the species have highly elaborated traits that on the surface, they appear to be very maladaptive. So let's take an example of something like that. Here, these are examples of birds of paradise, and these are the males. Look at the elaborate plumage these males have. It's bright. These tail feathers are very long. They don't look like something you design for flight, right? So the question is, why do these males have these traits that seem maladaptive? I mean, you would think, if anything, you'd want cryptic coloration. We had a lecture on, remember, the lecture on Michael Nachman and Hopi Hoekstra's work on the pocket mice, right, the rock pocket mice. Cryptic coloration is very important to avoid predation, yet these males are highly, very bright, long plumage. These tail feathers don't look like they'd be very good for flying. The females of the species, of the same species, are often drab, right? The females look like what a bird should look like, right? It looks like it can fly. It looks like it has cryptic coloration. And there's other examples of highly dimorphic species. So here's Hercules beetles with the male with this very elaborate horn structure and the female, which is smaller. Elephants, the males have long tusks. Many mammals, the males have horns or antlers. And then here's an example of an extinct elk where the males had just gigantic antlers, 12 feet across. Okay, so this example of things you're probably aware of, just reiterating. You have this extreme sexual dimorphism, for traits that would have, on the surface, seemed to be maladaptive. Okay, so here's another example of a sexually dimorphic species that you're probably familiar with. Male and female lions differ. The male lions are not only bigger, but they have these large manes. And here's another example. In pheasants. Some have basically a spur on their leg that are used by males to fight against one another. And the females appear to actually choose their males based on the length of this spur on their legs. And then you have some males have this little kind of measly little fake spur that they use to trick the females into to mating with them, but they don't really fight. So why is this? Why do you have these maladaptive traits that that would appear to be things that natural selection would not favor? What Wallace and Darwin recognize is that, first of all, the sexually dimorphic traits, the elaborate traits, are usually associated with males, right? Are almost always associated with males. So it's the males that have what appear to be maladaptive traits. And the thought was this, that, you know, to be a winner in the natural in the evolutionary game, you need to get your genes into the next generation. They weren't thinking in terms of genes, but this is one way of thinking about it. There's multiple ways of doing that. One way is to survive. You need to survive, obviously, but you need to survive and reproduce, right? So it's not just survival; it's about survival and reproduction. So for some reason, these males have these traits are somehow allowing them to better reproduce. They have more access to females. Okay, so the females are either choosing the males based on these elaborate traits, or these elaborate traits have evolved by the males to help them battle other males for access to mates. Okay, that's the evolutionary explanation for these elaborate traits. That to be a winner, you need to not only survive, but you also need to reproduce, and that these traits are somehow allowing these males to have better access to females. So we'll go into some examples. There's two basic kinds that we'll be talking about today of sexual selection. That's called sexual selection, by the way. One type of sexual selection we'll talk about is male-male competition. This is the intrasexual selection, competition among males for access to females. The other type, which many of the women in the audience probably will like a lot better, is this idea of female choice or intersexual selection. That is to say, the females are actually the choosy sex, and they choose the males that they want to mate with. So a little bit about male-male competition. There's a number of different types of male-male competitions we see out there. One is with in-group dominance. This is what you might typically expect. One male is the dominant individual and has the majority of the matings with the females. Another type you see is a male defending a harem. Female defense polygyny is what this is called. Or a territory that the females are in. And one that we'll talk about is called lekking. Basically, a lekking species, or a lek, is a place where a bunch of males gather for the sole purpose of mating with females. I'll give you an example of a lek as well. Okay, so let's go within group dominance. Here's an example of within group dominance. For instance, in gray wolves, these packs of wolves will form hierarchies among both the females and the males, which are established by you know, aggressive behavior. So you probably, if you have more than one dog like we do in our house, one dog is always the dominant one. And if you have several like I did when I was a kid, there's definitely a hierarchy and dominance that you'll begin to recognize in these animals, right? One dog is the king of the yard and the others are subservient. They have a number of behaviors which you can clue in on pretty quickly to realize that, okay, you know, Trudy there is definitely the dominant dog, and Amber over there is the less dominant dog. Well, the same thing happens. That's a behavior that's ancestral to wolves, right? So wolves also have that behavior. If you don't have a dog, you have to talk to some friends that do have dogs. Here's an example of female defense polygyny. This is a northern elephant seal, and these are two males battling out to see who's going to get to stay on the beach where the females are and defend their little harem. These battles are tremendous to see. These males are much, much larger than the females. The females are, you know, maybe half the size of the male. And these guys are just tremendous in size. And actually, I only have one northern elephant seal story to say, which is probably one more than you have. But when I was an undergraduate here, I went to San Nicolas Island to help some researchers actually in this department. They're now colleagues of mine in this department. do basically intertidal work on this island. The San Nicolas Island is one of these channel islands off California coast, and it's basically the Navy, I think, is the people that control this island. But anyways, we're doing a survey, a bird survey, where everybody took a quarter of the island. I was just walking along the beach with my head in the sky looking for birds. And then I heard this thing that sounded like toilets flushing or something. I looked, and basically there was an elephant seal like 20 feet away from me looking at me. And I was like between the water and the elephant seal, which is like the worst place to be. So I hightailed it out of there. That's not much of a story, I guess, but it was kind of exciting. It was a big moment in my life. It's probably the closest I've ever come to dying, which is pretty pathetic, I guess. All right, so territorial defense polygyny. Here's an example of territorial defense polygyny is an impala, where the males will defend a territory. Right, so if another male comes into their territory, they get kind of pissed off, and they basically will fight the intruder until he either leaves or, I guess, this guy loses and leaves. Another example of territorial defense polygyny. One thing that I didn't really list, but is something to consider, is after mating, if a female mates with several males, you could also have this idea of competition among males can continue into which sperm actually fertilizes the egg. And so a lot is being learned about sperm competition among different males in the last 10, 20 years. And basically, there's all sorts of strategies which are actually quite fascinating to read about that different species take to ensure that their sperm are the ones that fertilize the egg. So for instance, in some flies, the male will mate with the female and then basically insert a plug. So say, okay, you know, try to top that, right, type of thing. Others, like if you compare, for instance, chimpanzees to humans, so chimpanzees are our closest relatives. In the last lecture, we'll talk about human evolution. Well, some chimpanzees are much more promiscuous than humans are. And so a female will mate with several males. And if you just compare the number of sperm in an ejaculate of chimpanzees, it's quite impressive to what a human male can accomplish. It's mostly because they're competing with other chimpanzee males, right? For the ones that had more sperm ejaculated are the ones that actually fertilized the egg. Right, so there is such a thing as sperm competition. This competition among males can continue post-copulation even. Okay, so that is the male-male competition. I just wanted you to have an idea. This is the type of sexual selection that I think many people think about when they think about, well, why do we have sexually dimorphic species, right? The males are bigger. They have these traits to combat other males. Well, there's another kind, which is called mate choice. And this is the idea that one of the two sexes is the choosy sex, and that those individuals are choosing their mates, okay? And there's two broad categories. So the question is, why would a particular individual choose a mate? Well, one is that the individual that they choose to mate with has resources that they can contribute. And there's non-resource-based ideas out there. There's something about the individual that the female likes. Maybe with the main hypothesis, we'll be talking about the good gene hypothesis, that the female is somehow choosing males that have good genes. But first of all, we need to talk about, well, which of the two sexes is the choosy sex? And in most cases, it's the females who are the choosy sex, okay? And this all goes back to anisogamy that I told you about, right? Remember, the anisogamy is this vast difference in the size of the gametes that individuals can have. We define the female as the one that has the big gametes, right? Remember, if you're ever confused about what a female is, well, get a hold of its gametes, and it's the one with the big gametes, okay? So they're the choosy one, and the reason is that eggs are the limiting resource. Go back to that Daphnia picture, if you can remember. Remember how much energy must have gone into producing those eggs, which represent a large fraction of that individual's body mass, right? That's a huge investment for an individual to make. Whereas a male, you know, the sperm are so small and so there's so little investment involved that the real thing that limits males is access to females, okay? So, you know, a typical male, you know, in our species, for instance, could, in principle, fertilize thousands and thousands, millions of eggs, right? That's not the limiting resource. Sperm is not the limiting resource for males. It's access to the eggs, or the females, I suppose, that are carrying the eggs. All right, so anyways, in most cases, the females are the choosy sex. That's because eggs are the limiting resource, or often it's the case that the parental care is the limiting resource if the species is one that invests a lot of resources into the young. But it's not always the case. Okay, so these are just to reiterate what I said. Eggs are expensive relative to sperm. And also internal fertilization carrying young to term can be costly for the female. There are a couple cases where it's not the females that are the choosy sex, but the males. So you have the sex role reversal. And I'll give you an example of this. But these types of things occur when the contributions by the male exceeds the cost of making eggs. So if the male is doing something, whatever that something happens to be, contributing lots of resources or lots of time and effort, then if that effort and time and those resources exceed what the female is contributing to just the production of eggs, then you can see you often see the males being the choosy sex. Or in some cases, you have very biased sex ratios, that is many females and few males. So it becomes the case that the females are experiencing the limited resource, right? They're not finding the mates they need to fertilize their eggs. So here's an example of this, the seahorse. The seahorse is probably one of the top 10 lists for best parents in the wild kingdom. They basically they have a brood pouch in their chest where the female deposits the eggs, and the male is the one that then sort of goes around with up to thousands of young and broods and cares for these young until they swim away, right? And so as far as the female is concerned, she gives the eggs and she takes off, right? Which is the typical thing that males do. They give the sperm and they take off, right? Well, in this case, the females come, deposit the eggs, the male fertilizes them, and then he has this huge brood of developing young little seahorse fish that he cares for. And so he's actually investing a lot of time and effort into the care and rearing of these fish. And it turns out in seahorses, you do have the sex role reversal. They're the choosy sex. I mean, they're very good parents, but I guess occasionally they do eat a couple of their young, but there's thousands of them, so what's a big deal? So you may slip up a little bit. Okay, so a little bit about mate choice. Why would you want to actually, should be a choosy? Why would a female, for instance, want to be very choosy in her choice of a mate? Well, there's a number of reasons. One is one that we'll talk about later when we talk about speciation, but you need to make certain you mate with the right species. And the reason, this seems kind of obvious, but in some cases it's not obvious because you have individuals that could be very, very closely related. That is, the speciation is either in the midst of occurring or has occurred very recently. And if the female chooses the wrong individual to mate with, the young will have a lower fitness just because of these issues that come up when you mate with the wrong species, right? Often you'll have infertile offspring or offspring that have lower fitness. They're not as able to survive. It could be that they choose because of basically better ability to fertilize the eggs, or you leave more offspring. It could be that the individual you choose to mate with provides food, for instance, or has a better parental ability, like the seahorse we just gave the example of. Or maybe this individual has a better breeding territory or defended resource. So in some cases you have birds, male birds will defend a particular area, a territory, and the female will go around to the different birds and decide with whom to mate. It could be that that there's low risks or hazards of predation, for example, associated with mating with a particular individual, or that this individual that you are mating with has some heritable trait that you like, that you think is going to be good to have in your offspring. All right. So here's an example of a direct benefit that a female can get by choosing a particular male to mate with. So in bush crickets, the male bush cricket will give the female what they call nuptial gifts. These are basically spermatophores, basically protein-rich globs that basically the male will slip to the female during mating, right? And these spermatophores can be very nutritious. They can and they can be also very expensive to produce. So they can be 30 to 40% of the male's body weight. So they're very costly to produce. And importantly, this is you can imagine this is a good meal for the female in terms of calories. And the more spermatophores, the bigger the spermatophore, allows the female to lay more eggs. So the female, you can imagine in this case, might be choosy based on resources. This male has a large spermatophore that he can contribute, allowing me to lay more eggs, okay? That type of behavior is easy to understand via natural selection or sexual selection. There's another type of idea out there, which is indirect benefits. There's something about that male that would be nice to have in your offspring, right? And this is this good genes hypothesis, that somehow these elaborate traits are indicators of a trait, some heritable trait that would be nice to have in your offspring. One is this handicap model, right? So one idea is this handicap model, that the trait itself, this elaborate trait, acts as a handicap, and the female can then judge the male based on this, the idea that, well, if this guy's been able to survive with this ridiculous tail, maybe it's a good individual to mate with. So what types of reasons would mating with an individual with what might be good genes that has good genes? Well, one is that if you choose the right male, a male that has good genes, that is heritable traits that promote survival, or for that matter, access to mates for its offspring, that those would be a trait that the female would want to. I'm completely bungling this explanation. Basically, you want good genes in your offspring so they can survive better, or reproduce better. Okay. The basic idea is that mate quality is indicated by some secondary traits. So there has to be some way that the female can look at the individual and be able to tell that, yes, this individual has good genes and that individual has lousy genes. All right. And so the idea is that the elaborate trait is an indicator for the good genes. So in order to show, this is a difficult thing to show, because you have to show that the good genes are associated with the secondary trait, right? The elaborate trait that you're trying to explain. Is that clear? I mean, if you looked around and good genes, you know, individuals with good genes, just by looking at that individual, you couldn't tell the individuals that had the good genes versus the bad genes, then how could the female ever choose? There would be no basis on which for the female to choose the individuals, right? In this particular case, the good genes, the quality has to be indicated by some secondary trait. The secondary trait also has to be heritable. And that there must be a heritable variation in the mate quality. All right, so we'll give you an example of this. Yes, good. So the example I'm going to give you is in the gray tree frog. It's Hyla versicolor. And the trait that we're going to be explaining is males have calls. So they basically sit around in a pond and they do the frog thing. They make calls, and the female goes, visits the frogs, and mates with them. All right? And there's two different types of calls that these males make, short and long calls. Okay, so the longer the call, the female prefers the frogs, the male frogs with the longer calls. And so this particular experiment, what they did experimentally in the lab is look at several different traits in the offspring of a female that mated with a long call or short call frogs. Okay, so for instance, what they do is then say, let's measure larval growth in the presence of high food or low food, and ask, were the offspring of the females that mated with the long calls better or worse or no significant difference than the individuals with the short calls? Well, it turns out, in either a high or low food environment, larval growth was faster if the females mated with a long call male. Okay? How about time to metamorphosis? This is, remember, frogs start off as tadpoles, right? And then they metamorphose into frogs, into adults. The time to metamorphosis is shorter in the long call individuals, and there's no significant difference. So when you don't see any entry in the cell, that means there is no significant difference, no statistical difference between the long and short call males in this particular trait. Their size at metamorphosis, there was no significant difference. The larval survival, there's no significant difference. The post-metamorphosis growth, there's a significant difference in the long call individuals. The long call individuals were the better ones. So basically, this is showing that not in all possible measurements of fitness in the offspring of these females, but in several of them, the long call individuals were better. That is to say, there's something about the genes in these offspring, a heritable trait, that allowed them to grow better to grow better in all these cases, or metamorphose faster if the female mated with a long call individual. So the long call is somehow associated with traits that allow these offspring to grow better. Okay? Remember, there's two parts to this argument. There's good genes that the female would like to have in the offspring, and those good genes are indicated by some secondary trait like feathers or a long call in this case. Okay? It's a two-step, you know, it's a convoluted but longer chain of reasoning. So the last two things I want to talk about sexual selection are Lecking and the evolution of Lex, and the sensory bias exploitation hypothesis for the evolution of secondary traits in males. So first of all, what is a lek? So basically, it's an aggregation of males which the females visit for the sole purpose of mating. So a bunch of males hang out, the female comes, chooses the male, and they do their thing. Okay, that's what a lek is. It's not like the males are hanging out in some place because there's food there. It's not like there's food. It's not like the only reason they're there is for the purpose of mating. There's no parental care in these species, so the female just mates and then goes off and lays her eggs, raises the offspring. It's not associated with feeding. It doesn't appear that there's any significant resources in these lekking areas. And the females have this opportunity to choose, so they can actually shop among the available males. So it's like a mall, so to speak, for the females. So there's some thoughts about the evolution of leks. So one thought is that these leks evolved because there's lower predation risks for the males and the females, or that just there's a passive attraction. If you have a lot of males in an area, that it's better for every individual male because the females will be more likely to come visit that area. There's this black hole model, which is that the females aren't particularly choosy, but they wish to avoid the dangers associated with mating. Or there's this idea of the hotshot model, which is the females are still choosing the best male, but the kind of the loser males are hanging out there just to have the chance to be near the winning male and maybe getting some sort of chance at mating. There's a good example of a lekking species. These are bowerbirds. And these bowerbirds make bowers. And what a bower is it's a nest, or a nest, because there's not like you actually lay eggs or anything here, but it's these elaborate structures that they build out of weeds and sticks that they basically do their courtship dance in. I'll show you a movie in a second. But the females come to these bowers and they judge the male based on, well, for one, on the quality of the bower. And they also often like these brightly colored bowers. So sometimes the bowers are decorated with like little blue objects. And I guess traditionally it's probably like blue flowers or anything that the male bower bird could find in the forest that actually was blue. But nowadays it's like likely to be little bottle caps or whatever that happen to be blue, right? There is an example of a bower bird. Here is a female checking out the nest. The male's doing his dance, the female saying, nice bower, pretty good dance, that's okay, I like that, but you know, we're not going to actually see the rest, because that would be, there's an example of a bower bird, but that's what they do, and then the female will potentially, I mean, she might just say, forget this bower sucks, and the male's not so good anyways, and go off to another bower that's usually in these areas. So to be a lek, remember, it has to be a bunch of males congregating to one area. So where are the other males? What turns out in this little area, within easy walking distance, for instance, are a bunch of other bowers that the males, other males have set up. Okay? And the other interesting thing is different species of bower birds have different types of nests. I think I might have a picture. Yes, I do. So here's some of the different types of bowers that males make. This one's kind of cool. It's like a little slalom ring here. Here's one that looks like a little teepee and so forth. But the different bower birds, I mean, the males put a lot of work into this, right? They're pretty impressive. Oh, I have to show you this just because it's so cool. There's a lot of research among evolutionary biologists in things like this, and there's a group of people that, in Maryland especially, who've been studying bower birds and bower bird behavior. And this woman, a graduate student, Patricelli, is working with Jerry Borgia, had this idea to test various ideas about the behavior of the males during the courtship behavior. And they basically, often the females get scared away. If the male's a little bit too vigorous, they say, oh, and they take off. And so they wanted to have a situation where they could make certain the female doesn't take off, so they made robotic females. And of course, they had to call them fembots, if you've seen the show, that movie. So here's a fembot in a bower, so the male's thinking, a female's in my bower. And what they'll do is they wait till the male's going off to get some food, and they sneak in and they put the fembot in there. And they go back. They're little remote controls, so they can control the behavior or the signals that the little fembot puts out. And this is the most pathetic movie I've ever seen. So here's a fembot, and here's the male thinking that he's finally made it. There he is. He's going to do his courtship display. The female seems pretty receptive. Maybe it's time to think. There he goes. So he's mating with the female. Sorely disappointed, seems very cold and aloof. Yes. And there is success. So there's the fembot. I mean, there's not a lot there. Okay, back to some more sexual selection. The last thing I wanted to talk about was this idea of the sensory exploitation hypothesis. And that is this idea that the males, a lot of the signals that the males are putting out are exploiting pre-existing sensory biases in the female. So for instance, for whatever reasons, the hearing in the female or that species might be attuned to certain vibrations, certain sounds excite the female more than others, would be an example. Or certain colors, that the female just has a sensory bias to perceive certain signals better than others. And under this model, the secondary traits in the males evolve to exploit these pre-existing biases. Okay, so for instance, in this particular example is Physalemus. These males attract the mates with using calls that have whines in them. I used to have a tape of this, and I can't find it, so I was going to play it for you. But basically, the males have a particular call, and they have whines, and sometimes they put in these chucks, all right? And the chucks are just a certain sound in the call that, you know, trained biologists can say, oh, there's a chuck in this particular species. The females, ancestrally, all these species have this call that has a whine in it. But the chucks evolved only in this Physalemus postulosum, okay? That's where the chucks evolved. It turns out that the female preference for chucks evolved before the trait did. And you can tell this because you can take these species over here, this other species, Coloradum, where the males don't have a chuck, but then you can play them artificially made calls where they have a whine and a chuck. And those females love it, right? They say, I like this song. And so they'd actually prefer males if they had a chuck, that just that the males haven't evolved a chuck. It evolved afterwards. Here's another example of the same so whine plus the chuck, the females prefer it. And you can actually test this experimentally in the lab. You basically give the little female choice, you do choice experiments. You let the female frog choose which direction she's going to move, for instance, in a recording. Here's another example. This is an example by Alexis Basolo. She was a graduate student at the University of Texas. We overlapped by like a year. She left well before I did. But she was studying swordtail fish, and they're called swordfish. They're type of platyfish. The swordtail fish, the males have this little extension in the tail, right? The females don't. So it's a sexually dimorphic trait. She was able to show experimentally in the lab that the females of this species, the ones that have the swordtails, prefer the swords. If you like cut them off, the females don't like it. If you cut them off and then add a little clear plastic tail, the females don't see the clear plastic, they don't like it. If you cut it off and then you add an abnormally long sword tail to it, the females love it, right? So they even like, the longer the sword tail, the better as far as the females are concerned. So in the sword tails themselves, the males have the sword and the females love them. How about over here, this other group of species that the males don't have the sword tails? Would the females prefer the males to have a sword? Turns out you can do the same type of experimental manipulation she did over here, and you can artificially give these guys a little sword, right, in the same position. And these females prefer these fish would prefer them if they had a sword. That is to say, they choose the artificially manipulated males over the ones that had the normal tail. So this is an example, again, where it appears that the sword preference evolved in the females before the swords themselves evolved. And this is just using this cladistic reasoning that you guys are being tormented with in lab. Okay? You're basically mapping the traits onto a tree, and you can basically show in these cases that the sword preference appears to evolve before the actual sword did. All right. So that's all I wanted to say about sexual selection. And I want to go on to another topic. Another one of these things that's difficult to explain. So these are the two types of behaviors that we can pretty easily explain. This is the normal natural selection, right? And this is pretty easy to tell which of these two individuals is the winner and which is the loser, right? This is the survival of the fittest, who reproduces and leaves offspring. I hope you now have some inkling that we can actually explain these elaborate male traits as well. We have another word for it, we call it sexual selection, but the basic idea is that it's not only about surviving, but you need to be able to reproduce too. And if you have traits that somehow allow you to get better access to mates, those traits can evolve, even if natural selection itself, good old survival, wouldn't, right? There's some balance between what the female is going to prefer and what natural selection, so to speak, prefers in terms of how long this trait, this elaborate trait, can get. Those are pretty easy to explain. But how about helpful behavior? Remember, natural selection is a very selfish mechanism. It basically helps the individual. You can't have a trait evolve if it helps others, right? And so that is one of the predictions of natural selection, one of the predictions that Darwin made. And yet we do have examples of helpful behaviors out there in nature. We have, for instance, in the Belding ground squirrel, there's a very famous example where in the Belding ground squirrel, some individuals will make alarm calls if they see like a hawk or some predator. And importantly, so everybody hears the alarm call and they scram, right? Importantly, the individual that makes the call, that makes the alarm call, has a higher chance of being picked out by the hawk and eaten. So there is a cost associated with being making the call. So, you know, if you have this choice, you see the hawk, do I make the call and scram myself, or do I call and then everybody scrams, right? It's a helpful behavior. You have sentinel behavior. So if you've ever gone to the zoo and seen meerkats, they're very cute animals, but they'll have individuals that sort of stake out and look around for predators. One question is, why do you see the sentinel behavior? Because they'll also make a call when they see a predator. You often have examples of nest helping. And the most elaborate example of all is what's called eusocial behavior, which you see in ants and bees and so forth, where many of the individuals forgo reproduction. That's about as big a sacrifice as you can make, right? Like, I'm not going to reproduce, I'll help you guys out, right? That's about as big as it gets. So basically, it's helpful behavior is the actor performs some beneficial behavior on another, the recipient. And the question is, how do you actually explain this behavior? Well, there's some we can actually explain pretty easily. So if the actor and the recipient both benefit, that's easy to explain, because it's not really selfish, is it? Or it's not really altruistic, is it? Both individuals are somehow benefiting. That's called mutualism. There's this other idea which is called reciprocal altruism, that you make a helpful act and you don't immediately benefit, but someday you will. Okay, we'll talk about that as well. And then we'll talk about kin selection, which is indirect selection, which is probably the most complicated but powerful explanation. So let's just go through some of these actions. So you have a donor and a recipient. In a mutualism, both benefit. Okay, that's easy to explain because it's not really particularly selfish, is it? Or it's not particularly beneficial or helpful. Reciprocal behavior, both individuals benefit, but you're gonna benefit eventually. So your benefit is delayed. It's not an immediate benefit, it's a delayed benefit. Altruism is where you do some behavior that hinders, you know, that hurts you but helps another. That's hard to explain, but we will explain it. Selfishness, that's the easy one, right? You benefit, that other guy doesn't. Predation is a good example. One individual definitely is not winning. And this is one that fortunately we don't see in nature, spitefulness, where both the actor and the recipient are harmed. Well, actually, my kids do that often, but that's the only place I've ever seen spitefulness is where they, you know, in my children. Okay, so mutualism, this is pretty easy to understand. Once again, both individuals, the benefits. So, for instance, groups of lions will actually collaborate, and basically, in a pride, they can bring down larger prey than any individual can bring down. Okay, so all the individuals benefit by cooperating. Is another example of a mutualistic behavior in bluegill fish. So, usually, in the bottom of these lakes, you'll see a nest. The males will form these nests of like little piled stones or gravel. And you often get nest sites with 50 to 100 males, so there's lots of them. It appears that this is mutualistic behavior because the predation is lower if you're surrounded by a bunch of males, for whatever reasons. You often see cooperation in male lions. So basically, you have one male lion who sort of is the dominant individual in the pride. All the other males are expelled, and so you often you'll have these males sort of wandering around that are loners, right? Well, if several of these male lions can often some of these loners can cooperate, and if they cooperate, they can oust the leading male in a pride, right? And then they both have a chance to mate with the females in the pride. So those are things that are fairly easy to explain, because even though you're performing a helpful behavior to another individual, you're benefiting as well, right? So how about reciprocal altruism? Is a beneficial behavior which is delayed? So you're going to get paid back later, so to speak. And this type of behavior can evolve under a number of circumstances. So first of all, this reciprocal altruism can only really evolve in situations where you're going to see this individual that you just helped again, right? If you just bump into the night once, and you help some other individual, and you never see that individual again, you have no chance to be repaid. This is obvious, right? So you have to have repeated interactions between individuals. So that gives you many opportunities for altruism and also to be paid back. You can't be too dumb. You have to be able to recognize or remember the individuals that helped you in the past. And the ways in which you interact with other individuals have to be symmetrical. So it can't be the case that a bully is telling you to be helpful to him, right? It has to be a case where you actually make the choice, right? So there has to be symmetrical interactions. So here's one example of reciprocal altruism. For instance, grooming of parasites in many primates. The idea is that eventually this favor is returned, especially in baboon females. This has been studied extensively. The grooming behavior has. Here's a more famous example. It's in vampire bats, which is pretty cool. There's a vampire bat. Basically, these guys hang out together during the day in groups of about 10. Okay, they'll have little nest sites where several of these bats will gather together. So it's often the case that when they go off to feed at night that they fail to feed. So they basically scratch like a cow's leg and they lick up the blood, right? So sometimes they fail to feed. Bats have very high metabolisms. I don't know if you know this. So it's actually a big deal not to get a meal in a night. And these nestmates will actually, they can share blood by regurgitating blood meals to the others in this little nest. And they basically, these bats, first of all, they share more frequently with relatives, which makes sense. We'll talk about that in a bit, and other individuals in the nest. But also they share more frequently with others that shared with them earlier. So this is the key point for the reciprocal altruism, the fact that these bats will actually share their meals more frequently with the ones that helped them out in the past. Okay, so they do remember the guys that helped them out, or girls, I suppose. All right, the last thing I want to talk about is kin selection. And this is a famous quote to give you sort of the idea behind kin selection. This is J.B.S. Haldane, one of the population geneticists who's my hero, mostly because he was one of these very witty people that could think of responses on the spot instead of a week later like me. But somebody asked him, would I lay down my life to save my brother? No, but I would to save two brothers or eight cousins. All right, so this is giving you a flavor for how altruistic behavior can evolve if the benefit is going to close individuals. Remember I told you that J.B.S. Haldane is one of these guys that was very witty. Here's some more of his very famous quotes, which I'll just give you because they're cool. The creator, if he exists, has a special preference for beetles. That's good. Four stages of acceptance. This is worthless nonsense. Two, this is an interesting but perverse point of view. Three, this is true but quite unimportant. And the last is, I always said so. And then he's also said, now my own suspicion is that the universe is not only queerer than we suppose, but queerer than we can suppose. So than we suppose it can suppose. So it's actually, he has other quotes. Some involve algebra, things that I think is kind of cool, but you guys, I didn't put that one up. So anyway, so some people like J.B.S. Haldane had some inkling of how you could explain altruistic behavior based on the relatedness of the individuals that are being benefited. But it was really William Hamilton who formalized this idea in the early 60s in this particular paper, and he's a very famous evolutionary biologist. Unfortunately, died quite young, and they don't give out Nobel prizes in evolutionary biology, but if they did, I'm sure this guy would have been a recipient. So basically, he came up with the idea of kin selection, and this is the complicated way of explaining kin selection. But the basic idea is you have some action that benefits another individual that costs you something. Right, so that you do some action, there's a benefit that this other individual gets, and there's a cost that you experience in performing this action. So you benefit and cost. And the other thing is that this individual that you're benefiting has some relatedness to you. Now the relatedness could be close to zero, meaning it's an unrelated individual, or very high, meaning the individual is very closely related to you. So the basic idea is this: if the benefit times the relatedness is greater than the cost you experience, then formally speaking, population genetics theory shows that that trait can spread through a population. So let me restate that. If the benefit to the other individual times your relatedness to that individual, if those two things are greater than the cost you experience in performing that action, then that trait can evolve. That altruistic gene can evolve in a population. That's what this is saying, all right? A gene for altruistic self-sacrifice will spread through a population. The cost to the altruist is outweighed by the benefit to the recipient, devalued by a fraction representing the genetic relatedness, all right? So we have a benefit times your relatedness. That has to be greater than the cost you experience, okay? Well, this is another way of saying it. Basically, if you do your algebra, you know, move the C to that side. That's the same thing, right? Okay, so this is again, the same idea. R is the relatedness. B is the benefit that this altruistic behavior or this helpful behavior confers on the recipient. Cost is the cost that you experience by doing that helpful behavior. And this basically brings up this idea of a new way of thinking about fitness. So remember, we talked about fitness. The population geneticist talks about fitness as, you know, the excess individuals you put into the next generation relative to other individuals, all right? And so what Hamilton came up with is this idea of inclusive fitness. It has two parts to it. Inclusive fitness is the part, just your general fitness that you experience because you have particular traits that allow you to survive or reproduce better. That's the type of fitness we talked about all the time, right? This is just the normal fitness that Darwin would have had in mind, right? You have particular traits that allow you to survive and reproduce better. Inclusive fitness is that fitness plus how well your close offspring, your close relatives survive and reproduce as well, right? So that is your inclusive fitness. And that's what this is trying to show. This is your normal fitness. This is the fitness of all the individuals that your helpful behaviors benefit, right? So if you do something that helps a bunch of individuals, even if you're weakly related to all those individuals, that your fitness can be high. I think I'll skip this. So it does rely on this idea that we can calculate relatedness. And I think we're starting to run out of time. This might be a good place to break, and we'll finish up altruistic behavior next time.